Hello and welcome. Another week has blown right by. It's Friday already, and we are here on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness, and I've been talking about it all week, folks. I'm really excited to have this guest join us. It's been a while since he's been here. He is one of the legends in the field, and it is always a pleasure and an honor to be able to share some time with him. Tonight, we're going to be spending the evening with Dr. Raymond Moody. He is the leading authority on near-death experience, a phrase he coined in the late 70s. Dr. Moody's research into the phenomenon of near-death experience had its start back in the 1960s, and the New York Times calls him the father of the near-death experience. Dr. Moody has also received the World Humanitarian Award in Denmark in 1988, and he was also honored with a bronze medal in the human relations category at the New York Film Festival for the movie version of Life After Life. He's here to spend some time with us, share some knowledge and insights. Dr. Moody, thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
It's always great and a pleasure to speak with you. I think you have periodically come to visit our show with Darkness Radio and now Beyond the Darkness probably
right.
About a half dozen times over the years, and you've always got some great information
to
share.
That's amazing.
And now that we've kind of rebooted with Podcast right. One, I wanted to make sure to bring you back on, because one of the things that we've right. talked about over and over with different aspects is the idea that there is something that transcends our physical form, that we do live beyond what we believe there is to be. And you have shed some really interesting light on subjects. And one of the experiments that you've done that has really fascinated me over the years is working with the psychomantium chamber. And I know we've talked about this in the past, but I'd like for our new audience and new members to kind of catch up on this a little bit. Talk to me a little bit about what the inspiration was for you to start utilizing a psychomantium chamber, and what were you hoping to accomplish by doing that?
Okay, well, I got a laugh at the beginning to think that, as I think back, that really I am such a bore, because all of the things that I'm noted for, near-death experiences and the psychomantium, and you're talking about in form. For me, they stem from an interest that may seem to people totally unrelated. And this is going to be very counterintuitive, but since I started life as an astronomy buff, and then I went to the University of Virginia at age 18 to study astronomy, but quickly got diverted to philosophy, which I stuck to, and went on to get a PhD in philosophy there in 1969. And what drew me in was I came into this with the afterlife to me was a cartoon. I didn't know that anybody thought it took the idea seriously. It just never occurred to me because, you know, I thought of this family that I was in, it was not very religious. But in high school, I'd gotten a little interested in philosophy. So I took a philosophy course my first semester at UVA, and the first book they handed to us, Professor Hammond, to read was Plato's Republic. And that's where the whole story of my work begins, because immediately just reading the first few pages of the Republic, I was hooked. I'm like, wow, how does he do this? And also, Plato was the very first person I ever had any contact with who took the idea of an afterlife seriously. I mean, to me, it was in the realm of fantasy or humor. So anyway, and I had decided pretty much that already as a kid studying astronomy, that what always stood out in my life that was I could be sure of is my consciousness, right? I mean, I could be sure that I'm conscious now, but You know, I mean, as crazy and even psychotic as this may sound, when people make the inference that there is an external physical world because of recurrent patterns in their consciousness, now you've got to stop there, really, and think about the difficulties of getting across that gulf. But anyway, there I was reading Plato's Republic, and it quickly became obvious that this man, who was so brilliant, took the notion of an afterlife seriously. And so the Republic culminates in the story of a warrior who was believed dead on the battlefield but spontaneously revived at his funeral, and related about getting out of his body and going through a passageway into another world. And I believe there's something about seeing his life in review there. But anyway, I just thought, I mean, to me it was so extraordinary, but Plato obviously took that seriously. You know, said this, you know, the big deal. He took it as an indicator of an afterlife. Now, I talked to Dr. Hammond about that, and he said, well, yeah, as a matter of fact, these early Greek philosophers were fascinated with these cases of people who were revived and apparently died and came back and told these stories. Well, now, at the same time, we read Plato's Phaedo, which is the, you know, as crazy as this may sound, and anybody with a, you know, sort of fundamentalist theology is going to think this is anathema, but the historical fact is that the Christian theology of the afterlife came through Plato's Phaedo. That's where it came from. And you can read all about it in legitimate books of religious studies and such. But anyway, in that context, as incredible as it seems to us in 2017, Plato's contemporaries, for example, people who were of the ancient Greek world, is like, what did the average citizen think a philosopher was? Well, the average person thought a philosopher was a person who probes into things up in the air, or walked on air was one prong of it, and the other prong was, or probes into things down under the earth, which was the code word for the afterlife. The Greek view of the afterlife was you just settled down into the underworld, right? And that same semester, it's the most wonderful education. Oh, God, it was just so great. And I took a liberal arts seminar in which we read the classics of the Greek drama, tragedy and comedy. And a contemporary of Socrates was Aristophanes, who was the comic playwright. And in one of his plays in which he makes fun of Socrates and philosophers is called The Birds, and it concerns how the birds are reporting things they've seen as they fly around Greece. And at one point they say, far away in Webfoot land and the swamp of dismal dread, there we saw foul Socrates come calling up the dead. And this was the marker that one of the things that people ascribed to philosophers was participation in the ceremonies and the experiences in these oracles of the dead, which are a very fundamental thing to know about to understand the development of Western thought. I mean, this is not New Age stuff here. This is the historical reality. So these early philosophers, from which all of Western thought originated, by the way, were themselves regarded as dealing with calling up the dead or studying near-death experiences, or what we call near-death experiences. They called it by the term anabiosis. Was a person who would die and be revived. And so I had learned separately at that same semester in Herodotus, the Greek historian, that tells this amazing story of the tyrant of Corinth, Periander, who was a just gosh-awful beast. But anyway, he and to illustrate the, you know, the terrible things just that this character did, Herodotus says at one point, he's like, and you know what he did? It's like he had lost something that a friend of his had given him to take care of, or misplaced something to a friend of his. And so Herodotus saying, you know what he did? It's like he sent a delegation to the Oracle of the Dead among the Thesprotians on the river Acheron, which is in the current, it's in the northwest corner of Greece, directly below Albania. You can actually go there and visit this amazing facility. And it's just, the Greek literature is all full of references to these amazing oracles of the dead. A really great book to read. Now, I wrote a book on it published in 1993 called Reunions, but also somebody wants more scholarship in 2001, a great book called Greek and Roman Necromancy was published. The author is Daniel Ogden, O-G-D-E-N, professor of classics in England. And it's Princeton University Press, 2001, Greek and Roman Necromancy. And oh my God, I mean, it's just every page. It's all about this, how these oracles of the dead operated and so on, and how they influenced philosophy. Now,
did you believe, by reading all of this, did you believe that they truly were communicating with the dead? Or was this a philosophical debate of what they were really doing?
Well, it was more like, what in the world is this all about? It's very intriguing information. Now, in 1985, one of these places, I read a book, a classical journal, in which one of the archaeological excavation of the most famous one, the one that's portrayed in Homer's Book 11 and that Plato also alludes to in Aristophanes. And I found out that the Soterios Thakouros, who's a well-known Greek classical archaeologist, had just decided to, as he said, trust Homer and Herodotus. I mean, just go up there and say where they said it was, and other writers too. So quickly he found this structure and excavated it. And what they found in the excavation was a chamber. It consists of an amazing place like these rooms that were used as dormitory rooms in effect, but they had like this incubation suite, and they would stay down there for 29 days, and on the last day would feel their way through a darkened corridor in complete darkness and crawl down through a little entranceway into a dark maze and negotiate that maze and come out the other end into this hallway about, I guess, 80 feet long. I don't know, not too long, and about maybe 15, 20 feet wide. And at the end, they found the remnants of a bronze cauldron, okay, now surrounded by a banister. Immediately from that, I realized what they were doing, because as a psychiatrist and a psychology professor, I had studied this process of what's called crystal gazing or mirror gazing as a way to illustrate to my students of psychology that there were parts of their mind that they didn't know about, like unconscious processes that they could tap into for creativity or just for general interest. And so this was, you know, something I've been doing for several years, and basically I just put two and two together, and plus I also had studied these Greek magical papyri. You can get a set of them from the University of Chicago Press. If you just want the the texts themselves, it's volume one, but the volume two is great commentary on all these things. And you can see it in there. They had these recipes for you take a saucer, for example, and you pour olive oil in a white saucer and olive oil in it, and then by candlelight in the darkness you chant magic words, magical words that intentionally don't have any meaning to them. That's the point. It's not like there's a secret meaning. It's the fact that the magical nonsense itself is what puts people into the appropriate, or helps to put them into the mental state for calling these kinds of things up.
Okay.
So anyway, and it just came together with a lot of other reading I'd done all over the years. So in 1990, I purchased a place out in the country, and I set up a chamber with a dark chamber with a mirror. The one I used was about 4x4. It helps to put aesthetic appeal into this, right? I mean, you want people to have a nice experience. And I had just figured from studying Lucian of Samosata, one of the greatest, funniest guys who's ever wrote, who sort of made fun of the oracles of the dead, but because of his parodies, you know, a parody has to be based on the reality in some degree, right? So you can kind of see what they were doing. They had these people down there for 29 days in the darkness, and they talked to them, you know, like, what was this person like, and so on. And I had learned from my studies of psychology and teaching this at a university or a college, as it was then, now a university, that, you know, many people have this, you know, capacity to just sort of get down into that mid zone, and what you can see, you know, we have visions naturally arise. So anyway, set this up and had a thought that, well, you know, if I do 50 of these over a 5-year period, I'll probably get about 5 people who experience it. I mean, I was just thinking this couldn't be too many people who do this. And I was patient, but anyway, so my first subjects were my graduate students of psychology. Most of them had been out already in some profession, or some of the older ones, and some of them have been doing therapy and that sort of thing with as in various clinics and such. And so we just had a curiosity, you know. I mean, it wasn't anybody was coming to, you know, and the expectation that it would occur, but rather these were students just like, let's see what happens. And we knew the history and so on. So one at a time, they came out to my place in the morning. And basically, I figured out, just ask them to choose one person who has who's passed away that you would like to see again. And to tell me about this person, you know, it's like, what are your good memories? What are your bad memories? What are the feelings that come up? What were the difficulties in the relationship? What has your grieving process been like? I mean, just the common sense things, you know, of counseling and such.
Sure.
Talking with people who are going through grief. So anyway, expecting, you know, and imagine my surprise when the first one worked. I mean, very dramatically. It was just, and far beyond what I thought.
Can I ask you a question, though, Dr. Moody?
Yeah.
You say far beyond your expectations. I would think psychology would say, if we talk about something and we're kind of front loading our mind for a possible experience and then kind of putting them in a deprivation chamber, if you will, with very limited stimuli, that the mind is a very powerful thing.
This is perfectly expectable. That's right.
Right.
But you see, it's just once you think of it in those terms, but at another point of view, look back on how people heard this a few years ago. In other words, it makes sense. It does. And also that there are aspects of this, for example, I mean, I have studied hypnosis. I've hypnotized people. I'm a good hypnotic subject myself. My personal opinion is this is something to say this is hypnosis doesn't, this is some other kind of thing because of the intensity of the three-dimensional vision effects, for example, the feeling that you go through a mirror into some other reality that that the images come out of the mirror and so on, which is what people say. And to me, I have never looked at this work from the point of view of answering the question, is this real or not? See, we set a major trap for ourselves in this whole field of investigating the paranormal when we pose the question, is it real or not? Well, how do you answer something like that? To me, what I'm interested in is first and foremost, I mean, this is so pedestrian in a way, but hey, you know, it's my life. This is how I came up, you know, my thought process was, oh my God, this is what all these ancient Greek writings that I'm so fond of is all about. I see now, right? And including, it seems to be the model that Oracle of the Dead was with. As I gather, I mean, I can argue for this, that amazing scene in the middle of the Republic of the Cave allegory scene is, you can tell, and there's even a reference in it, a cross-reference in there, so you can see that Plato had that in mind in this whole thing. And so, to me, see, this is just a very, very influential concept in the history of philosophy here. Now, even more so is the apparently, now this is, there are legitimate scholars. I mean, I could give you Oxford Books, Press books and so on, but let me just summarize to say that the logic, okay, logic just didn't arrive. I mean, we weren't just born with logic. This was the product of a long historical process that was just absolutely fascinating, which involved many things like the martial arts, for example. That became an input into the development of logic. It's like Plato said, you know, instead of just shouting out your belief and shouting your arguments behind it, you interact like wrestlers, right? But one component of it was the father of deduction is regarded as Parmenides, who was a sort of second generation student of Pythagoras, who was a mystic of some sort, who worked in one of these oracles and it might have been, for example, a dream incubation oracle, but however. Apparently, he would cross over to the other side, and some of these early philosophers were very shamanic-like figures, and on one of his passages over to the other side, he was sort of abducted by a goddess who sang him this song, which is the very first written-out logical deduction, okay? And she said, Parmenides, when you go back to Earth, don't tell people to believe this because the goddess says so. Tell them to work it out in their own minds and see it for themselves. And, you know, what makes an argument deductively valid is that if the premises are true, then the conclusion must also be true, all right? First premise, A is taller than B. Second premise, B is taller than C. Conclusion, A is taller than C. But people had to develop that concept by gradually observing after the origin of literacy that what we would call propositions are related in certain logical ways. If this here and this here, then this here. But the formal concept of truth as you and I formulate, understand it, had not been formulated clearly. So anyway, that's what Parmenides did in this document. And so then when he went back to Earth, you see, and his students would sing this song, because it was like a song, over and over again until they had a sort of epiphany in which they could see the necessary connection between the premises of the deduction and the conclusion. And that was just a major event in human history. I mean, that is a major insight for people. What it boils down to is the insight that some things are the case independently of what anybody thinks about it, and that is the concept of
logical truth, right? Yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah, now, and that's what's so important about this. Now, you think of that. What's the importance of these oracles of the dead? Well, one of the things is that, at least according to its originator, this deductive logic came from these things. So, see, that's my take on this, why I find it so exciting. And so if I can say, well, my God, look, that's what these people say. It's like now you read the ancient Greek accounts and you say, sure, yeah, this is what they were doing. And it makes a lot of sense now. And also Empedocles, another one of them, allegedly was an evoker of the dead on there were oracles of the dead down on the slopes of Mount Etna in Sicily. And because anywhere the earth came up from underneath and touched the ground came up from underneath and touched the earth sea was, for the Greeks, that was a plausible place to have an oracle of the dead where the spirits would be accessible. I mean, something that's laughable to us now, but, you know, they had a geographic locale to it. And and then there was another, oh my God, I was just really excited a few months ago. I just saw it.
I was going to mention one thing. Part of the reason I asked about like the front-loading aspect, we did an experiment out at the Houghton Mansion, and we had set up a room to be a psychomantium experiment with the mirror and very low-light setting,
dark room,
and just trying to isolate. I didn't have any real expectations. I just kind of figured nothing would occur. I brought in a recorder, I put it under my chair, and I didn't really know what to do or how to do it, but I just kind of let things evolve. And my thought was at that time, I was going to try to communicate with my grandparents to see if they would make themselves known either through electronic voice phenomena or through appearing in the mirror. And I had a series of very strange things take place in the mirror.
Oh, how interesting.
Yeah, I had tried it for a while where I was underneath, where you couldn't see your own reflection. And I thought, okay, and nothing was really taking place. As my time was winding up, I kind of positioned myself where I could see myself, but I allowed my vision to just kind of blur and look beyond myself. And I noticed I don't even know how to explain it. It was almost like a projection of my friend Jeff Belanger's face start hovering over the mirror. And I was trying to rationalize what I was seeing, and I said, well, good try, but Jeff isn't dead. Jeff's alive, and he's downstairs doing experiments. What are you trying to show me here? And the space would just kind of hover there and then slowly fade into the darkness and then kind of come back and then fade. And then finally, this face started to develop out of the darkness, and it was this friend of mine, Father Andrew Calder, who had passed away recently. And I had no expectations. Remember, I was trying to question to see if I could get my grandparents.
Yes, exactly.
And this face appears in the mirror, and I said, Andy, am I seeing you, Andy? And he gave me this smile, and I said, I just had this weird knowing, Dr. Moody. And I said, okay, I'll let
I understand. This is what I hear from people.
And I said, I'll let Evie,
his
fiance Evie, I said, I'll let her know you're okay. And he just got this beautiful, peaceful smile on his face, and his face just vanished from the mirror. And it brought me to tears. I broke down crying because I had no expectations of seeing something like that occur.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable situation.
It is. And I have noticed that many times. See, people, you know, I mean, in terms of trying to think of this merely in terms of hypnosis or suggestion, I prepare people to see some one particular person there who's lost. That's how we talk. But in about a quarter of the time, some other person shows up. So it doesn't exactly operate on what you would wish, but it seems to be much more correlated with what people kind of need. That's what people generally say. Not in every case, but generally they'll say, you know, as one woman told me, she said, you know, I was thinking I wanted to see my husband, but she said, And then she saw her father, but she said, and then when I looked back at it, she said, yeah, I kind of see that I wanted, didn't I, that the person I probably needed to see was my father. And people often talk of it in those terms. So, and what is continually just a baffle to me now, so many people, I mean, people just, almost everybody interprets it to be a real event. That's still a baffler to me, although I must confess, right. Same thing happened to me. I mean, I'm astonished now.
Well, can I ask, what are your perception? I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. I'm just curious on this, though, before we move too deeply in. When we're having an experience like this, I'm curious what your thoughts are. And again, I'm not looking for a definitive answer, but I often wonder, is this part of our own psyche projecting, maybe through our third eye, in order to deal with traumatic situations? Because in the sense of Father Andy Calder, I didn't make it to his funeral. I didn't make it to see him before he passed. Mm-hmm. I had felt this guilt and remorse over that, and he came through. And I don't know if that was a projection of my own psyche coming through. Is this helpful?
Yes, I know. Isn't it interesting that we don't know? See, that's what I mean. It is an interesting thing. See, that in itself is fascinating to me, is that people, even very reflective people such as yourself, I mean, you're baffled. You don't know what to say. And yet I've had people on us, you know, some people say, oh my God, yeah, I mean, they just accepted at face value. And others, such as myself, I mean, I can't really form the words. That really was my grandmother. I mean, that just seems too beyond the pale, you know. But, you know, I don't know what to say. I really don't.
Now, you use this therapy, though, for helping with post-traumatic stress disorder, and you've had a lot of really interesting results with that, haven't you?
No. I think you must. Oh, you're thinking of Al Botkin. He uses
I know Al Botkin. Yeah, he uses the eye movement, but I thought that you had helped some people deal with some forms of PTSD by utilizing the psychomantium as well.
No, maybe somebody has done that kind of thing, but not me. Mine is more, most of the people who come to me are for curiosity. I have students who, for example, are in some psychological area, and they want to just sort of probe into this, see what this is all about. And and then others come for grief, but I talk to them ahead of time, or they get the message beforehand. Look, this is, don't come here expecting that grandma's going to show up, right? That this is more, what I can do is I can teach you how to ease into this modality and acquaint you with it to the point where if you really want to do it, then you can take this home and do, you know, just go on with it yourself. Because I am not a magician, right? You don't, it's, I mean, I can just, this was a folk custom in the United States. It's up till about 1915 or so. I was kind of displaced, I assume, by the radio age and then the TV, where people start, you know, assembled around the electric device to get, instead of just interacting with one another. But it was very big in the Victorian era, and that's, you know, that reading through the looking glass, you see that Lewis Carroll was obviously acquainted with this. He describes it very exactly what people say. As the narrator says, that as Alice goes up to the mirror, like the mirror dissolved in a kind of silvery mist. And that's exactly what people tell me. They say it's in. And, you know, a lot of people say that they feel like their consciousness is goes through the mirror into some other state of awareness. I've experienced that myself. And in other cases, how the images appear to come out of the mirror, step out of the mirror, and are experienced right in front of the person. In a distinct minority of cases, people feel that they were touched or hugged. And, you know, I guess to to reiterate about the most amazing thing to me. This is that contrary to every expectation I had, since these initially the people were my graduate students of psychology, okay, and also as word spread, the medical people in the community and psychologists and medical doctors said, hey, I heard about this. I'm just curious. It worked so well at first, almost everybody, but the motivation was just curiosity.
But is there any inherent danger? Before we launch into that next part.
I think this shows, generally speaking, that I think that when we start thinking about things that are we regard as paranormal, there is a kind of cognitive shift in our mind that is, I think it can be corrected or overcome, but it makes us sort of the boundaries of reality get blurry. Let me say what I mean. There are mirror factories. I think the oldest one is about 8,000 years old. It's the oldest place they've seen where they've found where people were making mirrors. And it was either 6,000 years ago or maybe 8,000 years ago. I don't remember whether it was, they included the BC bit. But, and they were made of copper at that time at this site. And before that, people regularly gazed into clear ponds and so on and saw things and fashioned crystals. The Aztecs fashioned obsidian mirrors, and Apaches used quartz crystals, and Cherokees used clear ponds and lakes, and I could just go on and on and on. But either way, and now these mirrors are in every home.
Mm-hmm.
My thought is, and we look into them every day without even thinking about it, it seems to me that if realistically there was any harm to come from gazing into a mirror, we would know it by now, is my thought. But now, I don't doubt that somebody could stir themselves up. You could build a helimantian, and just think about hell for days and watch movies. I don't get it. Imagine why anybody would want to do that, but maybe that would work.
Setting the intention is what you're saying.
Yeah. And the reflective part that comes before, like the thing, the talking about it and the reflection and and the recollections and so on. So,
well, we need to take a break. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We've got a lot more with Dr. Raymond Moody as the show continues, but we're going into the deep, dark archives of our show, and tonight's Theater of the Mind again comes from my personal journey, and this is one of the most bizarre and electrifying moments I've ever had experiencing and investigating the paranormal using the psychomantium at the Palmer House. Stay tuned. Next up is Theater of the Mind. The Psychomantium Experiment, another haunting true tale from the life of Darkness Dave. We had gathered for a paranormal conference at the famed Palmer House Hotel in Sauk Center, Minnesota, rated as the number one most haunted hotel by USA Today a few years back, and a location I've come to love as my second home. Throughout the event, we ran panel discussions and experiments, one of which was called the Psychomantium Experiment. I had taken one of the old fancy mirrors that once hung prominently in the lobby of the hotel and brought it to a small, dark, confined room within the basement, a notoriously haunted spot known as the door room. Many experiences have been logged in that room. Full apparitions have been seen, voices from thin air, people being touched by an unseen force, and the like. I felt this room might prove to be the best room to hold such an experiment. The mirror is hung on the wall right above a small dais. There's a chair position there with a tall white plastic pail upon it that small candles are placed on. This acts as the only illumination for the entire room during the experiment. Every 15 minutes or so, I would bring down a willing participant, explain the protocol of the situation, and leave them alone in the dark. in the most haunted and active room in the hotel. The objective is to deprive yourself of other stimuli, allow yourself to become one with the room and the reflection of the mirror. I suggested people let their eyes relax and look just over the top of their right ears and allow their vision to just slowly adjust, slowly let the darkness in and the play of lights. Some will stare into their own faces and welcome an experience. Now, no two are ever really the same. There may be similarities, but for the most part, each person has their own moment. I understand that with low light and gentle flickering, the candles can play tricks on our mind and in our vision, causing some minor visual disturbances. Those are not the experiences that excite me. It's when they see things that are not fleeting or plays of light like faces hovering inside the mirror, shadow creatures moving around behind them, or their own faces morphing into older or younger versions of themselves. And sometimes, they're lucky enough to hear things slowly pacing inside the room around them, or perhaps scratching at the wooden dais. On this particular day, one of the attendees sat with me in the lobby, hearing the experiences of the guests that would partake in the experiment. One woman could feel cold, strong hands grip her shoulders. She could hear a slow, deep breathing coming from the corner of the empty room. Another guest talked about hearing kids giggling outside the door and rattling the handle gently as if to try to scare her, but unable to contain their glee in doing so. Yet another guest talked about how the mirror would completely black out for minutes at a time with a rich, dark mist, and then it would dissipate, leaving the mirror clear again. At this point, Megan stated to me that she wanted to try it, but that she did not nor could not do it alone. She wanted me to join her so she would be safe. I tried to explain that that might detract from the entire experience, and that she would really be better if she went it alone, but her pleading eyes and mild begging finally broke my will, and I agreed to join her. After all, what kind of man would I be to ignore the pleas of a beautiful woman asking me to be alone with her in a dark, scary room? We entered the room. I went over the rules and then found a comfortable seat below and behind her, slightly to the right. From this angle, I was not part of her visual spectrum of reflection in the mirror, and yet I could still look into it myself. I took a deep breath and slowly exhaled as she nervously shuffled on the dais. We then went into silent mode. There was nothing for the first 5 or so minutes. Just the kind of silence where you can almost hear your own heartbeat in your ears. When suddenly and unmistakably we both saw the face of a small child appear at the bottom of the mirror, and it looked out at us as though he were on his tiptoes looking out through the bottom of the glass. At this point, I heard her breath catch. Then she began to say, "Please tell me." I interrupted with astonishment. "Yes, I see the little boy." It took everything I had to hold my composure. I mean, I was the big badass ghost hunter guy, and she was the damsel in distress who needed me to feel more comfortable. I swallowed hard and tried to keep my voice from wavering. It's okay. Nothing to worry about. They're just as curious about us as we are about them. That's what I tried to assure her. What was the real message in my brain was something more like, "What the f*** was that? I want my mommy." The little boy lowered himself and was no longer visible. Are you okay?" I asked. She slowly nodded, and we continued on. My mind was reeling. Had we really just seen that happen? I mean, this is horror movie stuff. My palms were sweaty, my brain was on fire, and I tried to keep my breathing calm so not to alarm her. I was sure at any moment, creepy kids singing from a horror movie would fill the room. I wasn't frightened so much as I was in complete and utter shock. I had never seen anything that weird or that cool before so clearly. The child posed no threat and didn't turn demonic looking in the mirror. But still, every Hollywood movie has always shown us nothing good comes when you see children's ghosts. After a few more moments of staring in the mirror from my angle, I decided to clear my vision and slowly rubbed my eyes and turned my head to the immediate right to stare off into the dark void surrounding us, hoping, praying that I would not see that kid in the room with us. After a few minutes of this, calm had washed back over me, and I turned my gaze back to the woman in front of me. That's when I noticed a strange anomaly. The way she stood with the candles in front of her and blackness all around, she cast a very bizarre shadow behind herself. It was dark and stood sentinel behind her. I'm not sure why it unnerved me so much, but something seemed off. Just not right. I looked around her and could see her watching wide-eyed into the mirror as she was clearly seeing something that, from my lower vantage point, was not visible to me. I turned my view back to the darkness to my right and blinked a hard few times, just to try to clear my vision and adjust my eyes. When I turned back, I noticed how much more pronounced her shadow appeared to be. Then, it started to dawn on me. This isn't right. No, not right at all. I mean, it made sense to see a shadow behind her because of the light source being faint and in front of her, and the shadow appearing directly behind her. But it didn't stretch to the ceiling or fall back on the wall behind us. It just stood there, behind her. I was starting to doubt my own eyes, and I slowly leaned forward in my chair and stared up at it. That's when my heart stopped. The shadow behind her slowly bent, leaning forward to match my stare. The shifting of my weight in the chair caused it to moan. That's when the shadow figure standing behind her bent at the waist, and its head got within inches of mine. All I could think was, "Holy fuck!" And it stood back up and returned to its normal position. Now, Megan must have noticed the light change and shadows move as well, because all of a sudden she quietly whispered in a hurried voice, "Can we please leave now?" "Yeah, sure," I said, almost cutting her off. Then I asked her to step over and turn on the overhead light, which she did happily. We stood there for a long moment, eyes wide, saying nothing, just staring at each other, captivated by what we just witnessed, frightened by the aspect of what it all meant, and glad to have shared it with someone else so we knew we weren't crazy. Well, not totally crazy. She turned and reached for the door and grabbed the knob. At first, the door wouldn't budge. She shot a look over her shoulder at me, concern in her eyes. Then she turned back and tried the knob again. This time it relented, and the door creaked open. On the way up the stairs, she informed me, "Something didn't want us to leave that room." I answered back, "That may be true, but I can think of two somethings that had a much different feeling about that." And we both let out with a nervous laugh as we hurried our pace up the old, noisy staircase. The door at the top of the stairs popped open easily, and we were suddenly basked in the daylight of the upstairs. We returned to our spots in the lobby and shared our story with the people there waiting. One after another, we related our stories. That moment will be forever locked in my memory as the single weirdest, yet most exciting and freaky time of my life, up to that point. More has happened since, but those are stories for another day.
Beyond the Darkness.
Oracles to the dead, life after life, life after death, near-death experiences. When you talk about these titles and topics, Dr. Raymond Moody is one of the first people that come to mind because of the interesting insights and the education that he shared on these topics. And he's here with us this evening as we've been talking about some of the other fascinating aspects of doing these scrying, this psychomantium type scrying to try to communicate, whether it's with the dead or just allow whatever is there to happen. And you know, again,
right. Or to be creative,
right?
Be creative. People, many artists use that. When I went around in the 90s talking about this, a lot of artists would come up afterward and say, "Yeah, I use this for creativity. I like gaze into the mirror and I see things," and so on. And yeah.
Yeah. The fascinating aspect to me about this too is, It's easy to sit on the outside and poo-poo it and say it's our mind playing tricks, it's our way of trying to deal with grief, it's this. But one of my friends, Jolie, who had attended one of the events we were at doing this psychomantium experiment, she actually brought a video camera in. And it was a small camera that she had trained on the mirror. And the damnedest thing, there were times when the mirror would go black. The light is still going, but something would black out the mirror. She was able to capture all of that on video. So here we've got this going on. It, to me, it was just one of the most unusual aspects of this. So again, we can start to eliminate parts of it's just the mind playing tricks, because there is this effect that even electronics are picking up on something outside of ourselves is registering.
Well, you know, I'm going to have to leave that to your expertise, I think, because I'm stumped on this one. I mean, I would love to look at your stuff, but, you know, to tell you the truth, I'm so unmechanical. I mean, I wouldn't have any sort of expertise that were relevant to, you know, anything electronic or anything. But, like I said, to me, the context is more the importance of this for the history of Western thought and the potential as a grief, you know, for grieving people. Arthur Hastings, you know him?
Yes.
Yeah, and you know Arthur passed away, as you may know, but he has published several good articles on this in 2012, I believe it was, in the Journal of Transpersonal Psychology. He printed the results of the long-term study he did with this, and he also wrote a chapter in a grief therapy book about the use of this. It was used apparently in the Middle Ages by occasional doctors who would use this for, I gather, grief relief in their patients. So things come in.
Sorry, you chopped in and out on me there for 1 second, so I wasn't sure if I lost your call. I didn't mean to go quiet on you.
But I was just saying there's a long history of this. It recurrently gets rediscovered and reformulated and, you know, reconceptualized.
What do you believe? Are we surrounded by a version of our own Akashic field? You know, people talk about auras, they talk about energy fields and things like that. Do you believe that surrounding us at all times are parts of our own memories and our own energy from our past that could be part of what we are, who we are, why we have these moments of clarity during near-death experiences, you know, maybe memories of past lives? Are we just always kind of, you know, kind of this magnetic field holding in all of this memory and energy?
You know something, I respect your question, and I greatly am flattered that you would consult my opinion on it, but I honestly have to say I am just baffled. I mean, I tell you what I think is one of the big keys to this is the whole question of what is it like to experience a change of dimension. In other words, assuming that there is an afterworld, which I now do, I mean, it's not something I would ever try to convince anybody else of, but it's through my process, I've sort of given up. I mean, to me, the idea is still very counterintuitive, but I think there are new ways of thinking about this now so that it's not, that even though the difficulties still persist, there are, I think, new ways of thinking about this that really conform to rational standards, because, you know, to tell you the truth, I do this for one reason, as I tell people. I do the inquiries that I do because it's fun. I do. Now, what I mean by that is that I just want to know what is. It started when I was 6, 7, or 8, studying astronomy. I want to know what is. And to do that, the very best procedure to do is to learn logic and critical thinking and reasoning just as well as you can. I am the professor of logic. That's what I studied. And I said in Life After Life that the background I bring to this as a philosophy PhD was logic and philosophy of language and ancient Greek philosophy. And that's where the action is still on these things, because these are still philosophical questions. They're not yet scientific questions. And so
Is there any part of your research that this many years later you look back at and you think, my beliefs have altered, my thought process on this has changed regarding any of this, or has it just grown and solidified, concreted more of your thoughts and your original work and research?
Well, the way in turn back to that thought about how I just want to know what is, it's so many people in looking at this kind of thing, they set out what they think already or wish to be. And then what they do is they try to string together some set of reasoning that will lead them to that point. And to me, that can't be fun because it's self-deceptive, right? If you're fooling yourself, you know you are by definition. What I want to know is what is. And so therefore, I just love thinking, but I want to think coherently and logically and soundly. And what that brings me to, and really trying to, because, you know, if you go off on a wrong tangent, you make an assumption that's too much, then you sort of lose track of what is. And so where I am on this, the psychomantion vision, so I can honestly tell you, I don't know. I'm just astonished beyond words about that it worked like it does. Because that was not what I was anticipating. I was thinking this would be. And that certainly the people that I was guiding through it, who were already educated in the human mind, graduate students who had studied the mind, that sure, and my medical doctor friends, will surely then say, oh, yes, I saw this image. It looked like my grandma, and was it real or was it a figment? I don't know. That was what I was expecting, and it was really just kind of startling that these accomplished people said, well, it seems to me, and I'm still grappling with that, and I just don't know the answer. And it's part of a broader thing to me. I had the wonderful experience of being an honors student in philosophy at University of Virginia. And that means that my third and fourth year of college, my only obligation was to go to my tutor one-on-one each week and to read them a paper and to be assigned a new paper on some philosophical topic and go back. And for a week, just write a philosophical paper on some philosophical topic. And it was a wonderful experience. Then I could audit any philosophy class I wanted to. It was just freedom. And, you know, and every word was questioned, right? You read your paper, and then what could it mean this and could it mean that? What a great education. And so, to me, my mind is just set up to be, because you've got to bear down and question yourself and just hash it out with yourself. I mean, and then to be always receptive to, like, your colleagues saying, well, there's this misstep here or this misstep there. So, you know, to me, it's very important to be rigorous. And where I can say for sure that I can do, for example, what can I do with this? Well, I can take people who are curious and who are analytically inclined, and I can take them through a rigorous process of reasoning that will, for example, give them a totally new, like an epiphany, like a whole new way of looking at paranormal phenomena, and do it as a sort of mental exercise that brings them rigorously to a sort of epiphany on this, where you just see, oh, yeah, this is what the paranormal is. Now, the very difficulty of this, see, is that it's isolated. Only a very few people are willing to sit through a extended analytic session of analytical thinking, because the charm of all this that you and I do see is the experiences and the narratives or the stories that come out of the experiences, right? That's where people who are in this field that you and I are in, they want to focus.
Right.
But that's never going to work. To get back, to get to the reality of it, you've got to sort of step aside from the stories and the experiences for a while and think through a very rigorous chain of reasoning that allows you to see some totally extraordinary conclusions that it, I mean, there's no reason even to say it at the beginning what the conclusion is, because it's so extraordinarily counterintuitive that nobody can see it unless they think it through for themselves. So that's the dilemma I'm in. I think that the whole field of the paranormal is, it's really become the proprietorship of the parapsychological mindset that looks at it as, you know, potentially scientifically provable, the pseudo-skeptics, who don't even know what that word skeptic means, by the way. It's what they are, is humanists. And so they just, misunderstanding the Greek concept of the skeptical philosophy, they use that as their watchword, but it's not what they are. And then the demonologists, right, who say, oh, it's real, but it's the, you know, the workings of the devil and such. But all three of those points of view really boil down to the same common assumption, which is that this is a literal mode of discourse that we are dealing with, see, and that's not true. When you talk about the paranormal things, you're talking in a sort of metaphorical. I mean, anyway, this is, I'm not going to belabor this now, but that is what it boils down to. And so there's ways to get out of this and to look at it from an entirely different perspective. But people have got to shift their minds, see, to really get, make real rational progress on this afterlife question. And the thing is, it's perfectly possible to do. It just takes a different kind of thing from the thing we all love to do, is to listen to the stories and to have the experiences and talk about the experiences. But you got to get outside of that framework to get back to it to see what it is. I know that sounds just so bizarre.
No,
but I'm
I get that.
I'm willing to put it to a test. I could, you know, like, it's, I'm going to give actually a presentation in a few weeks here on this, if you might consider coming or something and want to sit in on it. But it's just a whole new way of, of thinking this out.
I'm fascinated by the different aspects of this, right? If we're opening up our mind to the possibilities of this and allowing, and I think that's an important aspect of what you're saying. Sometimes we spend so much time in trying to dissect it that we don't just accept the experience for what it is and what it means.
Yes, yes. And then at the same time, you got to admit that then you really say, oh, wow, this is really new. But then your curious mind comes. Right, and you really, and the mind keeps working on this because it doesn't quite fit together. And what I'm saying is that you can, it's beneath the skin. It's there's something called inattentional blindness. And I'm sure you've seen these experiments and so on, but it's like, it's the point is that if you focus on one thing exclusively, then the most extraordinary things can happen around you in the environment. You never even notice them because you're focused on the one thing. And you might have seen these ones where they get people to start bouncing a basketball
right,
back and forth among each other and keeping track and keep your eye on the ball. And then they have this lady in a gorilla suit comes running through the room and nobody sees her, right? And that's what's going on in the paranormal. We're so focused on the stories and the experiences that something is lying right beneath the surface. It's playing out in the open that we're just not seeing. And that's the really fascinating part about this. I mean, that reason can crack this now, but it's going to take a separate kind of thing. And, you know, I'm just... And then the result of that is that then we can have an entirely new framework to think about these things, like the doing the psychomantion and so on, that gives us one that's not scientifically objectionable and is fully rationally sound. So I'm just really excited myself. I think that we're in for a whole new era in the study of life after death and the surrounding questions.
Do you think science is really taking a look, or do you believe that they have at some point really taken a look at this?
No, and I think, see, the problem is that this is not a scientific question, and I take that very seriously. You know, people, they just love that word science, even the ones who don't have any idea what it means. But as long as you can say it's scientific, then they feel good about it. But see, anybody who really knows about scientific procedure or what the scientific method is all about has major objections. No, see, the question of an afterlife is not scientifically verifiable. But does that mean it's not an important question? No, it's the most important question of existence. But it's still a philosophical question, see. A big question like this typically flexes through a philosophical discovery before it ends up in the realm of science. Look at Galileo, for example, or, you know, where you basically, he just thinks of a whole new way of thinking of motion, like rolling the balls down the inclined plane side by side and so on, and watching whether they hit the bottom at the same time or not. And so we got to go through a similar thing for the afterlife question, but we can do it now. We can actually open up our minds, recruit mental cognitive faculties, for want of a better term, that we didn't even know we had. And very simply, as long as you just like said, it's a matter of refocusing. It's really extraordinary. I mean, again, I can sort of prove this. And
right.
Like I said, if you're interested, we can. I'm going to do one of these in a few weeks to basically just to get this dictated and all done. But it's we can talk about it, and if you want to come, that's fine.
Well, let me ask you about this. Now that you've been open to all of this, you've been a part of these experiences and experiments for so long. Have you noticed a change in your perceptions? Have you noticed sensitivity, mm-hmm. empathy? Has there been something that's triggered in you doing all of this work?
Yes, there has. There has, however. See, I was 18 years old when I came across this. I'm now 73. I would say that it's impossible to separate all the other factors from that, see, because just all the other things that have happened and life development comes up in certain kinds of phases and so on. And so at the same time, I remember very clearly reading at the age of 18 in Plato's Phaedo, where Plato said, philosophy is a rehearsal for dying. And even at age 18, that hit me with a big impact. I thought, wow. Well, now at 73, see, wow. I have never known anybody who regretted majoring in philosophy. And I'm among them, because I tell you, it's just the greatest thing. It's big things that you and I are interested in. These are philosophical questions rather than scientific questions. So, but we can actually reformat our mind to think about this in a genuinely rational way. I'm saying that because I can prove it. Yeah.
I love that aspect of you, and I love that you're open with that side of what you believe is going on. You know, and like you, I want to know, I want to experience, I want to be open, and I'm working my butt off trying to shut down the over-analytical side and just kind of allow things to happen. And even, you know,
listen, don't do that. Don't do that. That's the way into it. I mean, it's like you've got to go through the analytical part, see. Plato pointed out that there's always got to be a story, like a near-death story or a story that he knew of these two, people seeing the dead, these oracles of the dead. But he said, no matter how many stories you got or experiences, you've got to have a set of concepts to link the stories with the notion of an afterlife. And that's where we're failing. And the kind of person, I guarantee you, who's going to do well with this is exactly a person of an analytical mind. I keep saying to you here, I'm asserting this is something I can demonstrate. And, you know, it's so interesting to me that very few people have taken me up on this. I'd like to, I mean, what I'm saying is that I could construct a proof. I could take people through a, it takes about a day, through a reasoning procedure where you just look at, I mean, it's just totally non-intuitive, but you see, you go through and see certain obvious facts that can be seen by anybody. And you can go from these facts into seeing what the paranormal is from a whole new. That's the challenge I'm issuing right here and now.
Well, then I'll put you to the
to
test.
Everybody listening, I can prove this.
I would love to do that with you and be a part of that experiment.
Well, great. We can do this, and this is the challenge, and then you can.
And
after going through this, you can tell the other, you know, the listeners and all what you think about it. Because, oh, my God, that'd be great to me to have somebody to be take through this. And then
let's put it together then, and have it happen. I'd be more than pleased and honored to work with
you. And this, all right, let me state very clearly what I can do, okay? Or, and not I can do, but you can do. It's like that I've discovered this way it works. Okay, now.
Okay.
A person who is genuinely approaches the afterlife from the rational perspective, not from the perspective I want it to be, and therefore I'm going to come up with some argument or reasoning, but rather from the perspective, all right, I really want to look at this question very severely, right, and see what is about it. Now, whether it is or it isn't, just to get closest that as we can. And so somebody who looks at it from that point of view, that kind of person, has almost unanimous agreement, even people of common sense who look at it this way. When you read this remark of David Hume to them, this say, yeah, that's what it is. David Hume was one of the founders of what we call the scientific mind. He lived from 1711 to 1776. He was a Scottish philosopher, and he articulated some difficulties with the inductive reasoning that scientists use and explored the notion of causality. Okay, now, somebody asked him to write an article or essay on afterlife things. So this is what he said. He said, and follow these words as I say them, and you'll see that it makes sense. He says, by the mere light of reasoning, it seems difficult to prove the immortality of the soul. Now that is an understatement, because you look at all the thousands of years of attempts. All right. So then he goes on to say, some new species of logic is requisite for that purpose, and some new faculties of the mind, that they may enable us to comprehend that logic. Right? Now, Hume loved irony, and probably that's just an ironical way of saying that it can't be, right? That he's setting down the conditions that are obviously correct, really. And because, you know, this Aristotle's logic, we've used it very well for 2,300 years. I mean, the idea that we can just come up with something to replace that, that's odd. And on the other hand, we think we know our minds pretty well. So the idea that we would have some cognitive faculties that we didn't know we had that were going to enable us to understand this new species of logic, all of these just things seem completely impossible, and yet it's only by meeting those criteria that we are going to be able to move forward in the afterlife question. Well, what I am claiming here and now is I can show you how to do it. Not so much I can do it. I mean, I can do it, but so can you. And I can take people through a procedure. If they got to degree agree to step out into the unknown and to look at some very counterintuitive things, but to go through a long process of reasoning, which does end up with genuine insights into the afterlife. Now, this takes me to do the whole full-blown thing will take 2 days is the difficulty. But
that's no difficulty
surely
for
there's
me.
Some way. Okay, great. All right, so we'll set this up. We'll figure out how to do it. You know, like some, and so that will be your challenge, and then we can come back on and we can see whether, and maybe even get some other participants too to give us, because, you know, yeah, we'll see. We'll figure it out how to do it.
I'd love to, yes. Yeah,
and I would get, and I also make the further claim that many of the people, maybe not understanding what skepticism is, falsely characterize themselves as skeptics, will come to see through this that, oh my God, yeah, there is a way of looking at this to make a genuine rational breakthrough in the rational study of the afterlife. That's what I'm claiming.
All right.
Staking my reputation on it.
I'll be happy to participate, and I'm sure I could involve a few other researchers who would love to be a part of this with you, and we could do
great.
This. So let's talk about it. When I mentioned earlier that I want
to
shut off the
minimal expensive. I need some minimal expensive
of course,
Xeroxing stuff, educational materials, and all. I mean, it comes with quite a bit of like exercises and stuff that I have to get printed up and stuff. So.
That's fine. Yeah. Whatever it takes, I'll be happy to pay in, and as will the other attendees on this. So that's not a problem. And when
right.
I mentioned earlier that I'm trying to shut off the analytical side, it isn't to the sense to I just dumb down and accept everything. But I also want to stop worrying about, you know, once you've had the experience, it's great to have the experience and move through it and do some thinking. But then to over-rationalize, it kind of takes away the power of the moment that you had as well. And that's what I'm trying to work on.
It does. It does. Well, another way of looking at it is that you are assuming there that logical thought is not a spiritual modality.
Interesting.
To the Greeks, it was. See, right? It's like... See, the Greeks wouldn't be able to distinguish, as you and I do, between the intellectual quest and the spiritual quest. We're thinking about enlightenment here, right? Jefferson and Franklin, but before then, they were connected.
Well, Dr. Moody,
they still are to me.
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Is there a website and information people can go to find out more about your research, your books, your films, anything where they can get all that information?
Lifeafterlife.com is a good one.
Lifeafterlife.com. We'll make sure to include a link for that so that you can find it. Dr. Moody, thank you so much, and I'll look forward to talking to you. Let's do this experiment and get it done.
Likewise, this is going to be fun. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. Let's get together and make a genuine breakthrough in the rational investigation of life after death.
I'm in. With my overwhelming fear of death, I am more than happy to look into this and respectively
great.
Do it. So, yes, thank
terrific.
You. Well, thank you.
Terrific.
Have
right.
a great rest right. of your night, sir. All of you listening, be safe, be kind, love one another. We'll be back with you again next week with a whole brand new week of the best in Paranormal Talk Radio. You've been listening to Beyond the Darkness.